Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'm coming to you from Portland, Oregon, where we have a beautiful, sunny, crisp day. We've gone about 2 months in Oregon in the fall without rain. It seems simply extraordinary. We are told by the weather people that we're going to have a lot of snow in the course of December and January. And you know what snow means in Portland? It means we all collectively forget everything we ever learned about how to drive. So we're all definitely looking forward to that. I've got a really good First Thursday coming up for you. I'm going to be talking about some bargaining cases. There's going to be a bargaining focus today. I'll talk to you about two very important principles that come to us from separate cases in Florida. One a police case, one a firefighter case. I will also be speaking to you about a major firefighter staffing case that comes to us from the state of Washington and Washington Court of Appeals. And then lastly, time allowed, I'll bring you up to speed on some recent developments, both in the negotiations front and in arbitration, on pre-statement review of body camera video. But before I do that, once a year, Mark Fuller, who's the guy who basically runs LRIS, commands, and when Mark commands something, I do it, he commands that I encourage all of you to become subscribers for LRIS's premium podcast series. And I'm a really great believer in it. If you're not a subscriber, in addition to First Thursday, I record a second and sometimes a third podcast each month. Almost all of those have been interviews with practitioners around the country, both on management and labor side. In order to get those podcasts, you have to be a premium podcast subscriber, and we bundle a whole bunch of stuff together in a package for you. So for $150 a year, you get access to all the premium podcasts and the library of them. They go back quite a while now. You get a PDF version of five of our books, The Rights of Law Enforcement Officers, The Rights of Firefighters, Public Sector Collective Bargaining, the FMLA, and the book on the FLSA. And you also get a monthly printed newsletter for those of you who still are reading things in print. Every month I put together a newsletter. It's called Public Safety Labor News. I have typically anywhere from 12 to 16 articles per month in that newsletter that I write about cases that have been decided in the last month. We have tables on recent disciplinary cases and recent collective bargaining cases. All of those, I think, are very helpful to practitioners. But best of all, with this premium podcast series, you get access to the interviews. The most recent interview we published, which we just published a little while ago, was with Mike Raines and Rocky Lucia of the California law firm of Raines, Lucia, and Stern. We talked about all things body cameras. We had intended for the interview to last about 45 minutes, but we got to talking so much that the interview went on for almost an hour and a half. It was just a wonderful conversation. Rocky and Mike know more about body cameras than I could ever aspire to learn. That didn't stop me from picking a little bit of a fight with him, a good-natured fight, and it all came out very well. It was a very good discussion. We're going to be publishing very shortly an interview with Ron DeLord. Ron is the historian of the police union movement. He's been involved with police unions since, or for the last 40 years down in Texas. He knows more about police unions and where they've been than any other individual that I know. And we talk about, I think, a very, very serious issue, and that is what it is that police unions need to do to adapt to the current environment and to prosper in the coming environment. We also have interviews coming up with two specialists in wellness, separate interviews, And we'll be talking with some folks from California about a fascinating alternative to traditional workers' compensation claim processing. All of that and much more on the Premium Podcast series. So with that, I'll shut up about the whole topic and let's get to the cases. To understand this first case, you need to understand something about Florida's somewhat unusual public safety collective bargaining system. So under Florida law, you have a basic meet and confer statute. That means that the parties are obligated to sit down and negotiate over wages, hours, and working conditions. If they can't reach an agreement, eventually the employer has the right to unilaterally impose its last best offer. Florida has a bit of an interim step between bargaining and unilateral implementation. There is something called a special magistrate process. I think of it kind of like fact-finding. You have a neutral third party who comes in and makes recommendations as to what the contract should say. But either side is free to reject the special magistrate's recommendation. And then if that happens, the employer can unilaterally impose whatever its last best offer was. Here's the kicker, though. An employer can only unilaterally impose things that are themselves mandatory for bargaining. Now, it can unilaterally impose a wage structure. That's negotiable, right? As a wage. Can unilaterally impose hours of work, different types of schedules and the like. It can unilaterally impose health insurance. All those things and, you know, hundreds of others are mandatory subjects of bargaining. But what it can't do is unilaterally impose something that is not mandatory for bargaining. If something is a prohibited subject of bargaining, it's illegal. Or if it's a permissive subject of bargaining, neither side has to bargain over the issue under the law, whatever it might be, then the employer may not unilaterally impose whatever it is that issue might be. I've talked a little bit about this whole notion in the past, but this Florida case gives me a platform to talk about it much more. Where do employers run into trouble with unilateral implementation and imposing non-mandatory subjects of bargaining? When they're trying to impose a waiver. What do I mean by that? What's a waiver? Well, as you know, there is a principle of bargaining that's known as the continuing duty to bargain. It means that unless the union has waived the right to bargain over a topic, the employer can't make a change in past practices in the area without first negotiating with the union. And that's true even when the contract is in effect. Unless the contract gives the employer the right to make the change in that area, the employer can't make a midterm change in a mandatory subject of bargaining without first negotiating with the union. Unless the union waives the right to negotiate over that particular topic. Where do you normally see employers trying to get waivers of the continuing duty to bargain? In the management rights clause, the collective bargaining agreement. That's all a management rights clause is an attempted waiver of the continuing duty to bargain. Well, here's the deal. Waivers are not themselves mandatory subjects of bargaining. Now, I know there's a little bit of conflict about that issue out there around the country. Not much. The law is overwhelming in both the federal law under the National Labor Relations Act and decisions from state labor boards all over the country. The law is overwhelming that waivers are not mandatory subjects of bargaining. But because there are a couple of, I wouldn't call them dissenting views, but I'd call them twists on the notion of waivers and negotiability. For example, if you're in the state of Washington, you need to check to make sure that these principles that I'm about to discuss apply to you. But let's assume you're with the 95% of jurisdictions and waivers are not mandatory subjects of bargaining. What happens if an employer tries to unilaterally impose a waiver? Now let's get into the Florida case and talk about it. These were negotiations between the city of Gainesville, Florida, and the charmingly named Gator Lodge Number 67 of the Fraternal Order of Police. They were in bargaining for a contract to replace one that expired in 2016. They couldn't reach an agreement. They went through that special magistrate process that I talked about. The special magistrate made all sorts of recommendations. The employer rejected the special magistrate's report, or at least significant portions of it. And eventually, the city unilaterally imposed a new contract. Article 11.2 of the newly imposed contract deals with work shifts. And here's the key to this whole case. I'm going to read the single sentence that is important. That sentence says, "The normal workday for all employees covered by this agreement will be an 8, 10, or 12-hour shift in a 24-hour period as designated by the chief of police to meet the department's operational needs." Okay? An 8, 10, or 12-hour shift as designated by the police chief to meet the department's operating needs. When the city unilaterally imposes that language, among other language, Lodge 67 of the FOP files an unfair labor practice complaint with Florida's Public Employees Relations Commission. And the gravamen of the complaint is, hey, you can't unilaterally impose that language. That's got a waiver of our right to bargain over hours of work. And Florida's Public Employees Relations Commission agrees. The court, or PERC, says, look, we have held for years and years and years, and courts around the country have held for years and years and years, that an employer may not impose a waiver of a non-mandatory subject, may not impose a waiver of the union's right to bargain over anything that is negotiable. Can't impose a waiver of the union's right to bargain over changes in wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment. PERC says, we've long ago held that shift lengths, work schedules, and hours of work are mandatory subjects of bargaining. We've held things like starting times and quitting times are mandatory for bargaining, the length of the workday, work schedules, whether they rotate, whether all that sort of stuff. We have held that to be mandatory subjects of bargaining. And the question here is whether 11.2 calls for a waiver. Article 11.2 in this newly imposed contract calls for a waiver of the union's right to bargain over hours of work. And PERC answers the question, yes. Here's a quote from PERC's decision. The focus of the waiver inquiry is whether the language permits the city to unilaterally make a change to a mandatory subject of bargaining. Without bargaining with the FOP, we conclude that it does. The fact that the city is limited in its choice of shift lengths, has to do an 8, 10, or a 12, does not obviate the fact that the language permits the city to unilaterally change the length of the shift without bargaining with the FOP. Now, the city also made an argument, hey, we've got that operating needs language in there, and we need that. That's a management right for us to determine operating needs. And PERC says, no, I'm sorry. That does not make this proposal any less of a waiver than it would otherwise be. And here's PERC's conclusion in the case. Under this imposed provision, Article 11.2, the chief of police has the ability to unilaterally change the length of work shifts without bargaining with the FOP. The city has already done just that by changing the shift length to 12 hours. Perk ends up concluding, this is an obvious enough violation of the law that it awards the FOP attorney's fees and undoes the unilaterally imposed contract language and sends the parties back to the bargaining table. Now, that's not really a revolutionary holding. As I've said, states all over the country find that waivers themselves are not mandatory subjects of bargaining. So this seems like a pretty standard decision. But I have to say, as a bottom line, I disagree with it. Why do I disagree with it? Because I don't think that language is a waiver. Let me read it to you again. The normal workday for all employees covered by this agreement will be an 8, 10, or 12-hour shift in a 24-hour period as designated by the chief of police to meet the department's operating needs. Does that say anything about waiving the union's right to bargain over a change between an 8, a 10, or 12-hour shift? I don't think so. And in fact, once upon a time, I had precisely that case. And that case came out of Anchorage, Alaska. We had a newly elected mayor in Anchorage who decided that the police should no longer work 4-10s. They should work 5-8s. And his justification for that decision was, well, if they're working 5-8s rather than 4-10s, they're working an additional day every week. And there's 52 weeks in a year, that's the equivalent of 52 more police officers. I know you got to work through the math, and it's kind of difficult to come up with. The union actually made up T-shirts that said 5 times 8 equals 4 times 10, but I'm not sure the mayor got that math. Well, eventually the case went to arbitration, went to an arbitrator, and the key question was, did the contract waive the union's right to bargain over changes in work shifts? What did the contract language said? The work schedule for patrol officers shall be either a 5-8 or a 4-10. That's all it said. The city argued the same thing that the city of Gainesville thought, and that is that language gives us the unilateral right to change between 5-10s and 4-8s. That's the same thing Perk thought the language in the unilaterally imposed 11.2 did, was it gave the police chief the right to change those schedules. The arbitrator in Anchorage said, and I think she was absolutely right, not just because we won the case, but I think she was just simply right. She said, you know, waivers have to be clearly articulated under the law. We have to see language in a collective bargaining agreement that captures a, and this is kind of basic law principle on waivers, that captures an intentional relinquishment of a known right. For me to see a waiver in a contract in the area of work shifts, said the arbitrator, I want to see language that says the city shall have the right to change employees between 5-8s and 4-10s. I don't see that. And you know what? I don't see that in that Florida language either. But everybody in Florida assumed it's a waiver, and the fact that I disagree with it doesn't matter a bit. It's just I raised that point to show you how specifically you've got to look at contract language to see whether or not there is a waiver. Now, what's the importance of this case? Well, this case is important, I think, first of all, for what it says, and secondly, for what it doesn't say. In terms of what it says, it tells you that you need to be looking through your collective bargaining agreements pretty carefully to see if you've got a clause that waives the union's right to bargain, because that clause may not be mandatorily negotiable. Now, you may be thinking, hey, I'm in a binding arbitration state. We don't get into this unilateral implementation thing. Well, you can't refer a non-mandatory subject of bargaining to binding arbitration any more than you can unilaterally implement it. So you've got the same problem that an employer in a state that is a meet and confer state has. So the first lesson is look through the contract and just identify. Do you have waivers here or don't you have waivers here? Because if you have waivers, they may not be mandatory subjects of bargaining. The second thing is take a good hard look at your management rights clause. Management rights clauses, as I mentioned, they're intended to be waivers of the continuing duty to bargain. They may well not be mandatory subjects of bargaining, which means that a union can just sit back and fold its arms across its chest and look at the employer and say, you can't unilaterally implement a management rights clause because it's a waiver. Or you can't refer a management rights clause to arbitration because it's a waiver. And in fact, there's cases from around the country where precisely that has happened. Interesting case and very important principle. Now to our second Florida case. This is a firefighter case, and it deals with the issue of what's known in the law as direct dealing. What's direct dealing? Direct dealing is the notion that if there is to be an agreement concerning something that's mandatory for bargaining, wages, hours, and working conditions, that agreement has to be between the employer and the union. You can't have individual agreements between the employer and members of the union's bargaining unit about mandatory subjects of bargaining. Those aren't enforceable. Those were once upon a time known by the colorful phrase of yellow dog contracts. If there's going to be an agreement about something that's negotiable, a wage, hour, or working condition, the employer has to get the union to sign on the dotted line or the agreement won't be enforceable. Now, this Florida case that I'm about to talk about involves a bargaining unit member who got fundamentally confused about what direct dealing is. And I want to use this case as a vehicle not only to illustrate where the confusion was, but also to talk about where it is in the everyday public safety workplace you find potential problems with direct dealing. So what's the Florida case all about? It's an unfair labor practice complaint filed by a guy named Tom Jamison. He works for the East Lake Tarpon. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. I don't fish, so I probably have the name of Tarpon totally botched. Special Fire Control District in Florida. Jamison's unfair labor practice charge is filed against the district. The union isn't a defendant, interestingly. And he alleges that Tom McQueen, who's an elected commissioner of the district, engaged in improper direct dealing. What's the improper direct dealing that Commissioner McQueen engaged in? He communicated via Facebook's messenger system with Bobby Sullivan. Bobby Sullivan was a member of the bargaining team for Local 1158 of the IAFF, which represents the district's firefighters. And Sullivan admits that the conversation happened. So what you've got is two negotiators here, or two people in, you know, some position of authority with respect to negotiations. On the employer side, you have McQueen, an elected commissioner of the district. On the union side, you have Sullivan, who's a member of the bargaining team, and they're talking about bargaining, not at the bargaining table, but by Facebook Messenger. It's a DM conversation on Facebook Messenger. And Jamison, who's in the bargaining unit, for some reason, I wish we knew from the opinion, but we don't, objects to that and files an unfair labor practice complaint. Well, Florida has a system that you see in some states, not many, where if there is an unfair labor practice complaint that's filed, it's initially triaged by someone to determine whether it could potentially be valid. The triager, if that's a word in Florida, is the general counsel for PERC. And in this case, the general counsel throws the complaint out. And what he says is, look, Jameson, you got this whole notion of direct dealing. You got it fundamentally wrong. And I'm quoting here. It is not an unfair labor practice for a representative of the union and a representative of management to discuss negotiations which are occurring or even to engage in negotiations. While such discussions may violate, and he cites a Florida statute, which is known as the Sunshine Law in Florida, it's public meetings law. If the two were negotiating without giving proper public notice, the courts, not PERC, enforce the Sunshine Law. In other words, this isn't direct dealing. Well, what is direct dealing? And I'm going back to the general counsel's opinion, and I'm going to quote. Public employers are prohibited from negotiating directly with employees because it can undermine the exclusive status of the employee organization. Here, McQueen was not communicating with an individual member of the bargaining unit. He was speaking with a representative of the bargaining unit who was a member of the bargaining team. That's not direct dealing. All right, so what is direct dealing? I mean, what are some examples? How does this come up in the everyday public safety workplace? And the answer is it comes up all the time. First of all, you can have flat-on agreements about mandatory subjects of bargaining, one-on-one agreements with individual members of a bargaining unit that are direct dealing. The most common one I've seen is where you have an employee who signs what's commonly called a last chance agreement or a return to work agreement, where they agree to certain conditions in lieu of being fired. You sometimes see them with the extension of an employee's probationary period. You see them sometimes when you have lateral transfers come in who start at new wage steps, higher than the normal wage steps. Sometimes you see them when there's a deal cut for a special work shift for an employee in a particular bargaining unit. You also see them when the employer is even just communicating with bargaining unit members about something that's a mandatory subject of bargaining. So, for example, I've been recently involved in a case with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, where the improper direct dealing was the employer circulating a survey to employees saying, hey, do you want to work 410s? And if you do, sign up here. And that was improper direct dealing because it's one-on-one conversations, negotiations, agreements with individual bargaining unit members about mandatory subjects of bargaining. So if you're an employer and you're ever on the cusp of reaching an agreement with an individual member of the bargaining unit, think, is this potentially direct dealing? Because if it is, you want to get the union involved in the process. Let's go over to our firefighter staffing case now up in the state of Washington. And I've got to say, every once in a while, I'll read an opinion and think about the lawyering that was involved in the case, and I'll say to myself, wow, he or she knew what they were doing. And so it was with this case involving Local 46 of the International Association of Firefighters and the city of Everett, Washington. So what's going on in this case? This case involves negotiations for a new collective bargaining agreement. It goes all the way back to 2014, the case does, and that's because the case has worked its way through the court system. In negotiations for a new collective bargaining agreement, there was a discussion about the staffing clause in the collective bargaining agreement. Since 1974, there has been a staffing clause in Local 46 contract that established a minimum number of firefighters per shift. And that number has changed over time. Well, in 2014, the parties get to impasse, and one of the issues that's on the table is the union wants to increase the minimum staffing level in the contract to 35 firefighters per shift. The city says, nope, staffing per shift is not a mandatory subject of bargaining. We recognize, says the city, that staffing per rig, per piece of equipment, may well be mandatory for bargaining, but the law that we've seen from around the country is that staffing per shift is a management right and not a mandatory subject to bargaining. And I will say to you that as a general principle, what the city is saying is right. The usual result in these cases, when you see staffing cases in the fire service, is that staffing per rig is in fact mandatory for bargaining. I can give you cases from around the country that say that. And staffing per shift or staffing per population or staffing per square mile, those are not mandatory subjects of bargaining. That's the usual result. So what goes on in the Everett case that convinces the Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission initially and eventually the Washington Court of Appeals that staffing per shift should be mandatory for bargaining? And what Local 46 did in this case was to convince everybody that there is not a single rule or two rules, staffing per rig, staffing per shift, that really all of these cases have to be evaluated on their own merits. And the Washington Court of Appeals, in holding that staffing per shift was mandatory for bargaining, ended up accepting precisely that argument. Here's a sentence or two from the court's opinion. Every case presents unique circumstances in which the relative strength of the public employer's need for managerial control on one hand and the employees concerned with working conditions on the other will vary. General understandings, such as an understanding that staffing levels typically weigh on the managerial prerogative side of the balance of employer and union interest, may, of course, be informative, but care must be taken to recognize meaningful distinctions in the circumstances in different cases. So what were the circumstances here? What did the union prove? What has me sitting off on the side and nodding my head and saying, good lawyering? And the answer is that Local 46 put on a compelling case about the relationship between, in particular, safety and staffing per shift. Let me quote here, and this is going to be a longish quote. I'm going to read four or five sentences. It's more than I normally read, but this is pretty important stuff in showing the way that this sort of issue should be analyzed to the opinion. The unrebutted testimony of the fire department chiefs and captains supports Perk's finding of a demonstrably direct relationship between workload and safety. The testimony established that the increased demand to respond to calls resulted in safety risks to the crews on duty for each shift. Dr. Carrie Kuehl, that's an expert witness called by Local 46 in the case, testified about fatigue as it relates to safety issues with firefighters. He testified that firefighter studies show that firefighters were getting about 5.7 hours of sleep across a 24-hour period, something that placed them at a high risk for cancer, heart disease, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, and that was the nature of their work. The opinion goes on to say, occupational and environmental medical medicine expert Dr. Carl Brodkin testified about the correlation between the call load or exposure load that firefighters have and the exposure to disease. The expert testimony of Dr. Brodkin supports finding the increased exposure to hazardous conditions, the greater the risk to a firefighter to suffer disease and adverse health outcomes. So in other words, concludes the court, bottom line, substantial evidence supports finding that the increase in the number of calls responded to during each shift directly impacts the firefighter's safety, and Local 46 established shift staffing has a demonstrably direct relationship to workload and safety. Hence, staffing per shift mandatory for bargaining. Great job, right? Putting on those safety experts, getting the chiefs to testify. The court's opinion doesn't talk about it, but I would assume there was testimony from rank and file firefighters on the same thing. This was a union that didn't accept the general principle that staffing per shift was not negotiable, but instead went to the core of the issue. And the core of the issue is that it's not a simple rule. What's negotiable is where staffing has an impact on safety. And if you can show that, you can show that, or you will get the result that staffing is a mandatory subject of bargaining. By the way, those of you on the law enforcement side of the house listening to this are probably saying, what about us? We can't bargain about staffing issues. We can't bargain about the number of officers per shift or the number of officers per 1,000 population. And that, in fact, is right. I mean, when you look around the country at various opinions, they all say that staffing for police is not a mandatory subject of bargaining. But you know what never has happened in those cases, at least not that I've ever seen? No one's put on a case like Local 46 put on in Everett. No one has put on a case showing through expert testimony a direct correlation between law enforcement staffing and safety in the workplace. How could you show that? You could show it through workers' compensation injuries. You could show it by the exposure of police officers to stress and stress-related conditions. You could get at it through the very same approaches that Local 46 did. And I'll bet you we're going to have some law enforcement unions, certainly the ones in the state of Washington, taking a look at this issue and thinking, are we going to be able to show that we can bargain over shift staffing? Maybe. I want to wind up with our body cam cases, and we have two of them. One of them comes from Pennsylvania, and the other comes from Massachusetts, and they're sort of different sides of the same coin, perhaps. So the first one, Pennsylvania one, comes from Pittsburgh, city of Pittsburgh. Police officers there are represented by Lodge 1 of the Fraternal Order of Police. And the dispute starts on January 19th, 2018, when the city implements what's known as Order 69-03, also known as Body-Worn Camera Recording and Digital Evidence Stored System. Someone in the Pittsburgh Police Department must be philosophically opposed to readily understandable titles of orders, but in any case. So this order deals with a whole lot of different issues concerning body cams, when they're going to be implemented and how they're going to be used, all the sort of things you'd expect to see in a body cam video policy. But the key facet of it that I want to focus on is that the order largely prohibited pre-statement review of videos. which meant that the viewing of videos by officers on the scene of an officer-involved shooting or in-custody death was generally prohibited, a slight little safety valve, I'm going to quote, unless there is a public safety need to identify or search for suspects and or involved vehicles that may have left the scene. The city goes ahead and unilaterally implements this order. The FOP files an unfair labor practice complaint with Pennsylvania's Labor Relations Board. The FOP appears to concede in its complaint that the city had the right to implement the decision to have this body camera policy, but what it wanted to do was to negotiate over the impacts of the decision. So you can have things that are management rights that the employer has the right to unilaterally implement, but they could have negotiable impacts. And what's the negotiable impact that the FOP is keying in on here? The negotiable impact is that of discipline, at least primarily that of discipline. So how does the case go? It's heard by an administrative law judge. We don't have the full labor board's opinion yet. We just have the ALJ's opinion, but I wouldn't expect this decision to be changed by the labor board because it follows some pretty standard principles. So it starts with the city saying, hey, we didn't refuse to negotiate over this. We offered to meet and discuss the FOP's demand to bargain over the impacts of the body camera policy. The ALJ makes short work of that. And I love it when you read one of these opinions that captures a whole concept in a single sentence. And that's what this one does. The ALJ says, meet and discuss is, in the context of labor negotiations, a term of art which signals that the city was not willing to bargain. And ALJ is dead right on that. You, from time to time, see this. And, you know, it's not that prevalent because it's really a game. It's a word game more than anything else. But meet and discuss does not mean negotiate. It means we're willing to talk to you, but we're not willing to bargain. That's what the ALJ finds. Well, on to the meat of the case. Has the city any sort of obligation here to negotiate over the impacts of the decision? And the ALJ says yes. First of all, the ban on pre-statement review has clear disciplinary impacts. The ALJ describes the fact that, and I'm quoting, an officer is an accused suspect in manifest jeopardy, or maybe a witness who's required to give a statement subject to discipline upon refusal. Discipline for all of that is a very foreseeable impact of no pre-statement review. Secondly, the FOP has raised the issue of trolling. Trolling meaning that supervisors are reviewing body camera videos somewhat at random to see if there's evidence of misconduct on the part of officers, even when there's no complaint or no critical incident or anything like that. The ALJ says it's very clear that trolling has mandatorily negotiable impacts. Trolling, and I'm quoting here, gathers information the city would never have been able to gather through normal supervisory channels. Moreover, not only does it make it more likely that an employee will be disciplined, it makes the employee's ability to defend such discipline more difficult, as the employee can be confronted days, weeks, or months after the incident, whereas before the body cam policy, the employee could immediately explain an event to a supervisor. The ALJ refers to this fact, the fact that, you know, you may not get around to asking the employee about what happened on the shift for weeks or months, refers to this aspect of the city's policy as, and I'm quoting, particularly problematic. So, bottom line, the ALJ says, city, you got to rescind the policy. You got to go back and you got to negotiate over the mandatorily negotiable impacts of the body camera policy. That's not a radical decision. Almost every labor board that has confronted this issue, really save one. There's a case to the contrary out of Hawaii that ended up getting settled. But every place else I've seen where you have a labor board or an arbitrator that has looked at a body cam system, they have found that there are mandatorily negotiable impacts to the body camera system. Now, let's travel to Massachusetts for the other side of the coin. And what's the other side of the coin? It's what happens if you negotiate these sorts of policies, and in particular, if you end up before an arbitrator. I'm describing here a case involving the city of Newton, Massachusetts. It's not actually a body cam policy. It's a video policy, and it dealt with video systems that were in place on department property, police department property. The video systems were primarily used to record access at building entrances. They were used in the cell block and booking areas and in the headquarters library. They also provided some exterior surveillance of the parking lot and the area around the building. When the city implemented this new video system and the new and a policy that accompanied the video system, the union, and the union in this case is known as the Newton Police Superior Officers Association, so it's a supervisory union, demanded to bargain over the policy. And the employer didn't contest whether or not bargaining over this policy would be mandatory for negotiations. But they couldn't reach agreement on everything. And the main thing they could not reach agreement on was whether or not there would be pre-statement review of the video. And that ends up, when you have a disagreement about a mandatory subject of bargaining in Massachusetts, that ends up in binding arbitration. Binding arbitration, the last step in the negotiations process in most states that have collective bargaining. Goes before a three-person arbitration panel. What does the panel do? The panel says pre-statement review should be incorporated into the policy. The panel accepts the union's argument that what the policy does is to turn new technology into, and I'm quoting, an instrument for unjustifiably disciplining its members. That's the union's argument. While the policy says that the primary purpose is safety and security, it can also be used to discipline employees. And the panel ends up with the bottom line that the following language should be added to the policy. Again, we're in arbitration, so the arbitrator is actually writing the policy language here, and the employer is required to incorporate it into its policies. And what is the language? Police officers with union counsel and or representatives shall be permitted to view relevant video and images recorded by the video system prior to providing a statement, written or oral, pursuant to an internal affairs investigation into a non-criminal matter. What happens if it's a criminal matter? Well, then the policy doesn't apply to that, and the officer is going to have to make a decision. Do they want to invoke their Fifth Amendment rights not to give a statement until they see the video, or do they want to give a statement without seeing the video? This, to me, is not an unexpected result either, any more than the Pennsylvania case was an unexpected result. The evidence in favor of pre-statement review, and when I say evidence, I mean the scientific evidence about the benefits of pre-statement review, is starting to be pretty overwhelming. And if you put that sort of information before an arbitrator, and you also put the other concerns that are raised by pre-statement review issues, like the Brady implications of no pre-statement review, I think arbitrators are going to end up siding with whoever it is who is proposing that there be pre-statement review of video. Well, that's it for this edition of First Thursday. We hope to see you at an upcoming LRIS seminar. Remember, we've got our first ever wellness seminar coming up in Nashville in the spring of 2020. I wish you all a great holiday season wherever you may be, and look forward to having you join me for January's First Thursday. With that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.